This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on this edition of Ozarks at Large, we'll go behind the scenes for a big book fair to benefit Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville, get a preview of the upcoming Banff Film Festival, more from last week's debate between John Bozeman and Blanche Lincoln, and hearing the theremin like we've likely never heard it before. That's all ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. First up, 11 architecture students and their professor spent a portion of their summer vacation in Fayetteville repairing and documenting the family home of noted architect Fay Jones. He died in 2004. For their effort, they won a coveted prize and the knowledge they've helped preserve an icon. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich brings us their story.
Throughout his career, Fay Jones designed and built nearly 100 residences in Kentucky, Massachusetts, Florida, Tennessee, Virginia, Texas, California, and many in Arkansas. But one of the very first houses he designed and constructed was his own, on the crest of a forested mountain in East Fayetteville in the mid-50s. The project was initially called Hill 1 North. He also designed award-winning chapels, as well as offices, bathhouses, camp facilities, a medical clinic, botanical garden, pavilions, retreats, even a boathouse and dock. Fay Jones loved the outdoors and, as an architect, sought to bring the outside inside. Greg Herman is an associate professor in the Fay Jones School of Architecture at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville.
Well, Fay would describe his work as organic, natural, of the earth. Of its time, generally earth-hugging, low, comfortable, and soothing.
Professor Herman's also an award-winning architect and teacher, a three-time recipient of the Mott Outstanding Teacher Award, but he's also active in a number of service organizations, most notably on the board of City Build Consortium of Schools, which is facilitating community building in Katrina-devastated New Orleans. And he's making sure Fay Jones' residence will never fall into disrepair.
Looking around, you can see that it's stone, native stone from the area. Typically, there are ledges, as you would find in nature. And the wood, you'll see applied vertically in the position that it grows. That's very much a Frank Lloyd Wright legacy. And I would say that it has more overt, modern components than some of the houses that we associate with this more mature style. And this house suffuses the best of both of those worlds, what he learned in the education of modern architecture, and also what he took from his time at the Taliesin Fellowship and his life, his few years with Frank Lloyd Wright.
We're sitting upstairs in the dining room of the 2,000-square-foot, two-story home, yet you can see all the way to the master bedroom. A massive stone fireplace is the centerpiece. Lots of windows provide views of the pine oak and Chinese bamboo forest outside. There are no curtains here, and several exits lead to a wraparound deck. Professor Herman says although the home was clearly an experiment and some of the details were provisional, it's still in good condition. A few problems are apparent. Water leaks are visible on the ceiling, as is some checking. But when he discovered the ornate upper deck railing was falling off, he saw an opportunity to help Fay Jones' widow, Gus, and a teaching opportunity.
There is no complete set of drawings in existence on this house. In other words, when Fay built this house, he built it largely from sketches and coming on site and talking to the contractors and the craftspeople. There are a number of drawings in the Fay Jones Archive and the special collections at the university. Ellen Compton was very gracious in making that available to us and was really a partner in this all the way. Some drawings suggested a house slightly different from this one. So it was clear to us that there were really no complete drawings on this house, surprisingly. I think what happened was that Fay had intended to do so and just got caught up in life and got caught up in other projects. So it became our task to produce a full set of documents on the house. We produced them under the auspices of the Historic American Building Survey, or HABS for short, which is part of the National Park Service in Washington. The 11 students and I worked on the set of drawings intensively for 9 weeks. We submitted it to their annual competition for the best set of historic documentation of a historic building in the country. And to our surprise, we won first prize.
The Historic American Buildings Survey began as a Depression-era federal program for architects and draftsmen to document significant buildings before they disappeared. Although the Jones residence is on the National Register of Historic Places, HABS officials were glad to include it. The HABS Peterson Prize Competition provides a $3,000 cash award, certificates to all the students, and a great mark on their resumes, including Addison Bliss, a fifth-year architecture student. He took us downstairs to Faye Jones' studio called The Grotto.
The most striking thing about this house is coming into this grotto and seeing this boulder becoming one of the walls of the house. It's kind of the most interesting thing that I thought. It's not only organic in sort of the way that he likes to incorporate nature into his projects, it's also organic in the way in which he plans a project. If he finds something interesting on the site that he'd like to integrate into the final, in the realization of the project, he just leaves it. And so when you walk into this grotto space, you're confronted by this boulder that is the space.
Back in the 50s, when workers were excavating the foundation, they ran into a rock bluff. But rather than blasting it away, Faye Jones kept it, enclosed it in glass, and installed an indoor garden and trickling waterfall around it. A door exits the studio beneath a cantilevered upper concrete deck, which provides a nice shelter from the elements. But that deck also held standing water, repeatedly rotting away Faye Jones' hand-built cedar board and batten balustrade. He even tried to design a fix for it, but nothing worked. That is, until Addison Bliss designed a solution.
What we did was we pulled it away. So we came up with a flashing technique, a technique to keep the water out of the detail that covers both the structure and the guardrail. So when the water falls off of the concrete slab, it falls in between and down below.
It's raining this morning, and you can see that Bliss's copper flashing and aluminum spacers draw water off the deck, down the cedar wood, onto the stone walkway below. Faye Jones would be really pleased. White River Woods donated materials, along with help from Nabholz Construction. Tim LaTourette, the architecture school shopminder, facilitated repairs. Working with Addison Bliss was Chloe Costello. She's a third-year architecture student interested in sustainable design.
I was working on the documentation mainly. I helped coordinate the drawings. We had different sections. We had the plans of the house. We had the site plan. The sections of the house, which are more of seeing it in like the floors, the first floor, the second floor. Then we had details of the house, so that was concerning the furniture, the different, the lamps. One of the things about the house is that it has all different lamps that Faye designed.
Costello said she and her colleagues took lots of field notes and produced the drawings back in their class studio on computer. Joey Weishar, who's also in his third year, said it was an honor to work on the home.
But we did have quite a bit of fun measuring and just, there's so much to measure that it would just be like days on your hands and knees going around the house.
Any surprises? Did you discover anything that was not discovered here that the family wasn't aware of?
There were photographs of Faye with Frank Lloyd Wright that we found, and some of his old like war records that I'm not sure if the family knew because they were just so tucked back.
Personal photographs slid into crevices and cracks, purposely placed for some future person to find? Hard to say. Anyway, Joey Weishar says Faye Jones' work would totally fit in today's architectural movement.
I mean, for sure he would be, I think, a big proponent of the sustainability movement because his work is so natural and it draws on very local materials and just sources of inspiration. And sometime down the line, it'll be gone and someone else could use the site.
Although it's not likely this place will ever be allowed to dissolve. Professor Greg Herman.
Well, the Jones family still lives in the house. They're still living here and deciding on the future of the house. We're hoping that the School of Architecture and the University of Arkansas will be able to play a role in the future of the house and the future stewardship of the house, that we can develop a legacy program with this house in some way in the future.
Given the historic importance of the Fay and Gus Jones residence in the Ozarks, this precious home will likely someday become a public architectural pilgrimage, like Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin in Wisconsin. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The E. Fay and Gus Jones House led 14 other entries to take first place in the 2010 Charles E. Peterson Prize, to be delivered October 7th in Denver. To learn more about the work and life of Fay Jones, you can visit the University of Arkansas Mullins Library Special Collections section online at libinfo.uark.edu. And many thanks to curator Ellen Compton. This is Ozarks at Large. These stairs lead you from the ground floor of Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville to a large attic storage space. Here are thousands of books, boxed up and ready to be moved to the Fayetteville Square.
We have about 50,000 books that we're going to try to sell this year, again in our second annual book fair.
That's Dr. Martin Schopmeyer, Jr., the founder of Haas Hall Academy. 50,000 books have been collected by students at the public charter school. Classes at the school earn points for collecting the gently used books.
I've got suspense, mystery, you have theater, film, self-help, fiction, romance, every type of book conceivable, and they're all sorted in boxes, and they'll all be taken to the book sale.
The class and the individual students collecting the most for the annual sale that takes place this weekend earn prizes. If 50,000 books sounds like a large number for a school to collect, it is. Especially, Schopmeyer says, when it comes time to move those books from the school's new location on College Avenue to the sale location on the square.
We're just fortunate that we have a lot of students whose parents have books and they want to support our school. It's an idea for us to raise funds, because we're not given millage monies, to try to augment some of the expenditures that we have at the school.
Parents and scholars at the school will load the books onto flatbed trailers and move the books tomorrow night. The large book sale takes place Saturday from 7 until 4 inside the East Square Plaza on the square. The idea, now in its second year, was inspired by a similar event held for the past several decades in Tulsa.
Actually, Susie Stevens of Nibbles Cooking Academy approached us about the idea of having a book fair similar to what Holland Hall has in Tulsa. And they've been doing it for 50 years. And they have people that wait in line for an hour or so before the book fair, and they're full all day. And we felt that being an academic institution that focuses on school, certainly reading, that we would try to help the community by providing some sort of a book fair.
The Saturday book sale is open to the public. Those particularly interested may get a sneak preview Friday night at a preview party from 6 until 8:30 for an admission fee of $25 for a first right to purchase books. Up to 25 books can be purchased on Friday night. Martin Schopmeyer says last year's book fair, the first the school ever did, went better than expected. And he says that's been the trajectory for the school, an enterprise he first talked about on this program in January 2004. He says the 6.5 years since that first conversation about the school on the air have included a bit of a learning curve, a new location, and plenty of growth.
I think it's better than what I thought it would be, because certainly initially there are all these obstacles that you have to overcome, and then there are certain rules and regulations that you need to become familiar with. Once all that's behind you and being able to move into a more populous area of Fayetteville, we have about 1,000 people that have pre-registered their children through 2025. So there's longevity in the institution. We've proven ourselves academically, and financially we're doing very well.
The Haas Hall Academy Book Fair, featuring about 50,000 books, takes place this weekend in the East Square Plaza on the Fayetteville Square. The preview is Friday night, and the fair continues Saturday beginning at 7 a.m. For more information, haashall.org. That's Haas, spelled H-A-A-S, haashall.org. This is Ozarks at Large. music from Keola Beamer and George Winston. This reminder, if you hear a piece of music on Ozarks at Large that you'd like to know more about, you can find out the name of the tune and the artist at our daily rundown of the program at ozarksatlarge.com. Daily rundowns, individual stories, audio extras, sometimes even pictures and videos can all be found at ozarksatlarge.com. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals have the Texas League North Championship safely tucked away after winning a fifth and deciding game in the North Playoff Series last night. The Nats defeated the Springville Cardinals to claim the series. Tonight, the Naturals will host Game 1 of the overall Texas League Championship. They'll play the Midland Rockhounds, champions of the Southern Division. First pitch is tonight at 7 in Springdale. Game 2 is tomorrow night, also at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. Then the rest of the best-of-five series will be played over the weekend in Midland, Texas. The old home of the Naturals' in-state rival, the Arkansas Travelers, could be torn down to make way for parking and new facilities for the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. The school's plan for the former home of the Travelers has raised concerns from some about losing a piece of Little Rock history, Ray Winder Field. Medical school spokesperson Leslie Taylor says that the baseball stadium is in pretty bad shape.
It would be dangerous for somebody to play ball on it right now. Now, what we did offer in our original talk with the city was that if someone wanted to come forward with enough money to fix that up, to make it so that it was usable for ball, that they could do that. We haven't had anyone come forward with that sort of a proposal yet, though.
She says no decision has been made yet about what to do with all the memorabilia from Way Winder Field.
We expect that there will be some requests for some of that. We might want to use some of that in some sort of a memorial on the property ourselves. So right now, we haven't made any plans for that. We expect there will be some requests for some of that.
The University of Arkansas's Board of Trustees convened last Friday to discuss the proposal to buy the property from the city of Little Rock. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. On this edition of Ozarks, we continue presenting excerpts from the debate last week between Blanche Lincoln and John Bozeman, held in the Peabody Hotel in Little Rock. Four journalists from around the state asked questions of the two major party candidates seeking election to the U.S. Senate seat in November. In the second half of the debate, the candidates were allowed to ask each other questions. Today, a question I asked Senator Lincoln. Then we'll hear the follow-up from Congressman Bozeman and more conversation from each candidate. The debate was moderated by Roby Brock of Talk Business. Senator, tax cuts instituted during President Bush's administration are set to expire within a few months. Which of those tax cuts should be preserved? Which one shouldn't, and why or why not?
I think that it is absolutely critical in the economic crisis we find ourselves and the focus that we have on job creation and putting our economy back on track that we do need to be cognizant of the fact that we have to maintain some kind of balance and some kind of certainty in our tax code as we come out of this economic crisis. I think it is essential that we maintain the tax cuts for low and middle income individuals. And I think as long as it's paid for in a responsible way, that the tax cuts for others, but the ultra wealthy, I do not think should receive that tax cut unless it is paid for in a responsible way. And I think that's an important thing that we have to do. This is the first time in the history of our country. We have been at war now for almost well over 8 years. It's the first time in the history of our country that we've been at war, and we're in two wars now that we have not asked the American people to pay for it. And I think removing the debt that we see, bringing down that debt, making sure that we are growing our economy is going to be essential. So maintaining that balance and predictability in the tax code is important, but also making sure that we're being fiscally responsible in terms of certainly paying for any of those tax cuts that would go to the ultra wealthy is very important.
Congressman Bozeman.
Well, I'm very much in support of extending the tax cuts. I voted for them in 2003. Senator Lincoln voted against them. This has helped approximately 900,000 families in Arkansas. And again, I feel very strongly we need to extend them. Now, if we don't extend them, if we don't extend them on the so-called ultra wealthy, those making $200,000 an individual or $250,000 as a family, 50% of that income, 50% of the income involved in that manner is small business. And the last thing that we need to do in this economy is raise business on small businesses, particularly small businesses that are making money. That makes no sense at all. So I'm very much in favor of extending all of the tax cuts. And if not, this, along with so many other things that we've seen coming out of the administration, truly is a job killer.
Senator Lincoln?
Well, I just want to make sure I clarify that I thought you were only referencing the 2001 tax cut that I did support at a time when we had surpluses after President Clinton's administration, where he received tremendous debts and ended up producing a surplus, and I thought it was appropriate in 2001. I would also say that in 2003, we found ourselves at war. We also found ourselves not willing to put the cost of that war in the budget. And in order to avoid the kind of debts that we find ourselves in now, we have to be more responsible in terms of how we present those taxes and how we pay for them and how we deal with them. I absolutely support tax incentives for small businesses and have fought hard for that in my time and continue to do that. But I would say that in order to, and I've supported extending the tax breaks to the ultra wealthy, but it has to be paid for responsibly.
Congressman?
Well, I would just say this. I think there's a clear difference between myself and Senator Lincoln as far as how we regard taxes. In going to the Senate, I'm going to go there not to raise taxes. I'm going to go there to reduce our spending. That's the problem that we have. And the idea that we can tax and spend and borrow our way to prosperity, I think that's the fundamental difference that I have with Senator Lincoln and have with the administration.
Congressman John Bozeman and Senator Blanche Lincoln at last week's debate in Little Rock. Tomorrow, from the second half of that debate, the conversation between the candidates over health care and the plan passed by Congress earlier this year. And you can hear more questions and answers and discussions from the debate each day this week at OzarksAtLarge.com. The debate was organized and moderated by Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net. Support for Roby Brock's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at Hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And the Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com.
Well, time is running short again, so the award for the best performance by an actress, Grace Kelly for The Country Girl.
American actress Grace Kelly passed away on this date in 1982 from injuries sustained in an automobile accident. Kelly was born into a wealthy Irish Catholic family in Philadelphia and was educated in convent and private schools. She then attended the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York City in 1947, working as a photographer's model to pay her tuition. She made her Broadway debut in November 1949. She appeared in a number of television dramas in the early 1950s. Her first film role was a small one in the 1951 film 14 Hours. The next year, she appeared as Gary Cooper's Quaker wife in High Noon, and her career began to blossom. During the height of her Hollywood career, Kelly appeared in such films as Mogambo, opposite Clark Gable, and The Country Girl, for which she won an Academy Award for Best Actress. But perhaps her most memorable roles were in the Alfred Hitchcock films Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, and To Catch a Thief. Kelly was the perfect Hitchcock heroine, epitomizing what he called sexual elegance. After making The Swan in High Society, she retired from the screen to marry Prince Rainier, becoming Princess of Monaco. The couple had three children, and Princess Grace was active in charitable and cultural work. She resisted attempts to lure her back into performing, although she lent her narration to one or two documentary films, gave occasional poetry readings, and in 1976, she joined the board of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation.
The thrill of this moment keeps me from saying what I really feel. I can only say thank you with all my heart to all who made this possible for me. Thank you.
George Hayes was elected as the 24th governor of Arkansas in an overwhelming victory on this date in 1914. His tenure as governor saw a number of progressive reforms being undertaken, including a blue sky law to protect investors from stock and bond fraud, and a law giving women the right to enter into contracts and to own property. Francis Scott Key rode the Star-Spangled Banner on this date in 1814 after witnessing the British bombardment of Fort McHenry in Maryland during the War of 1812. The song is now the national anthem for the United States of America. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's the 14th of September, almost the middle of the month. It's a Tuesday. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up, founded Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And that's when I make the puzzled face going, what happened to July and August?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, they're in your rearview mirror.
Oy. All right. Tonight, there's a garden walk about fall blooming perennials. At 6 o'clock, the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks in Fayetteville. It costs $15, but you'll learn a ton of stuff. And you can find out more at 750-2620.
So it's a guided walk.
It is a guided walk. And tonight there are auditions for ages 10 to 18 for the next Arts Live Theater show called Night of the Living Dead.
Based on the movie, but something of a comedy.
7 to 9 o'clock at the Arts Live Theater facility. I'm going to go see if they'll let me audition. I can pretend to be 10.
Becca Bacon-Martin is editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. The beauty of film festivals is being able to explore foreign lands and cultures from the comfort of a theater chair. An international film festival is headed to Fayetteville this week to give audiences a taste of adventure that can be found in the mountains. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda gives us this preview.
The community will host a stop on the Banff Mountain Film Festival World Tour Friday at the University of Arkansas Global Campus in Fayetteville. The festival, whose films explore climbing, mountain expeditions, and remote cultures, started more than three decades ago in Alberta, Canada. The tour's on-site coordinator, Charlotte Tomlinson, explains.
The original Banff Mountain Film Festival started 34 years ago as a small afternoon event put on by a group of local climbers. They sold some tickets to a show that they thought was just going to be a small gathering of friends, and on the day of the event 34 years ago, twice as many people showed up to that venue as the capacity. So they did it again the following year and the following year, but that's basically how it started. It just grew from there. So it was originally a climbing film festival, and then it grew into a mountain and outdoor film festival. The festival that actually happens in Banff isn't just a film festival. There's a book festival, speaker series, gear demonstrations, trade shows, and more happening at the same time. So it's gone from one afternoon to a nine-day festival that people come around from around the world to see.
Tomlinson originally worked in the Banff Mountain Film Festival's office. She now helps set up screenings across North America on the festival's world tour and says she is living the dream. Each stop on the world tour is considerably shorter than the nine-day festival in Banff, so event organizers are selective about what films are shown.
We actually start with 300 films, which is a lot. That's how many entries we receive every year. We narrow that down to about 30 or so that would work well on our world tour. So in a screening on our world tour, we want, you know, shorter films so that we can show an audience a broad range of subject matter from around the world. So from those 30 films, we put together a custom program for each location. And what we do, the Road Warriors, that would be me, we're unofficially called Road Warriors. We obviously know the films quite well. We've played them to a number of audiences, so there's certain films that we know every audience is going to love. But sometimes we'll adapt the program. Some locations love skiing more than another location, so we'll have more skiing films at their stop. But we'll work with the local host and figure out what the local audience cares for. And we take great notes from year year to year. Our audience gives us some really great feedback, but each location is a custom program. So usually on an average night, you'll see somewhere between 7 and 10 films, ranging in length from 3 minutes to an hour, and we will literally take the audience around the world that night. You know, we'll start off with skiing in Japan, and then we'll be biking across the Americas. We'll do some paragliding in France, and we're literally all over the globe. So I would say that it's the cheapest round-the-world ticket you will ever get to sit in that theater and visit all of these world cultures.
When the world tour began in 1986, organizers started by expanding to a few locations in Alberta, Canada. The festival's popularity grew, and the tour now reaches 30 countries in all 7 continents. Early on, festival organizers would contact organizations they thought would be a good fit as hosts for the tour. Now, the audience dictates where the world tour stops. People from around the globe apply to host a screening. Some have to wait years for the opportunity because Tomlinson says they don't have the capacity to go everywhere. When sorting through the various applications, what are some of the main attributes festival organizers look for?
Well, I'd probably say passion is the number one. Obviously, an interest in what we're doing because a local host that has a passion for what this is all about will certainly put on a more successful event. But, you know, basically we always say that if there's a venue and an audience that wants to see it, we will come. And our venues have ranged from everything all the way at the top to the most professional run theaters you could ever imagine, some of the most gorgeous theaters from around the world, to, you know, we've had shows on tennis courts and in high school gymnasiums, that if we can get the equipment and the audience is keen to see the show, then the show will go on.
The proceeds from many tour screenings benefit a local outdoor program, community cause, or nonprofit. Tomlinson says seeing the festival help various groups of people is very rewarding.
The Banff Center itself is a nonprofit, so certainly any profits that we receive goes back into programming for the Banff Center. But because of the nature of our festival, we do work with a number of local nonprofits. So the models that we work with can range from either we are 100% hosted by a nonprofit, they've used all of the proceeds for their programming. Sometimes we'll work with maybe it's a local gear store or, you know, a local retail shop that's running the show, but they're giving the proceeds to a local non-for-profit. But I can tell you, I mean, some of the best letters that we get in our office are from those local nonprofits that have contacted our office to let us know what those proceeds have meant to them, you know. And it's just such a warm, fuzzy feeling to be sitting in your office and to know that, you know, the work you've done has quite literally made a difference in the world every day. And I know for me, one letter that certainly stands out was one of our shows was a fundraiser for a search and rescue crew. The search and rescue crew had used the funds from our film festival to buy state-of-the-art defibrillator equipment. When they sent us the letter, they told us how many lives they had saved that year with it. So, you know, we've certainly, you know, in some way contributed to saving wetlands and helping getting kids into climbing programs, all sorts of a range. But, you know, when it gets right down to, you know, someone's life has quite literally been saved as a result of the films that we're able to bring to the town, that certainly means a lot to us.
Doors open at 5, and the show begins at 6:30 Friday night. Tickets are $14 in advance and $16 at the door. More information is available at FayettevilleBanff, that's BANFF.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is PJ Robaski, music director for KUAF. And today, a conversation about an instrument that you've heard, though you probably haven't heard quite the way you're going to hear it today, and that instrument is the
theremin.
PJ, welcome back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
Thank you, Kyle.
Theremin, a few weeks ago, when we were having one of our Film Score Friday conversations, talking about science fiction movies,
right,
and how they use the theremin.
Right. And we had played some music from The Thing from Another World.
right.
which is almost all theremin that Bernard Herrmann had written.
But even then, it's theremin that's used sort of in the background to set a mood or a feel.
Yeah, and that was totally not the way it was intended. You know, first, just a little bit about Leon Theremin. He was born, actually, Lev Sergeyevich Theremin in St. Petersburg, Russia, and is considered the founder of electronic music. Now, in 1918, he used a newly discovered vacuum tube technology, and he designed and built the first musical instrument that relied on electronic oscillation to produce its sound. You know, our engineer would be so proud to hear me say that. You know, it remains the only instrument today, even, that is played without actual human contact. And it was named after the inventor, of course, and first became renowned in classical music circles. Leon Theremin was interested in science as a child and eventually studied physics and astronomy at the University of St. Petersburg. And if that wasn't enough for him, he also completed training of electrical engineering. Now, he tried to devise a new type of radio, and he had this configuration of vacuum tubes and antennas that actually involved into the theremin. Now, with the theremin, and you've seen the theremin, you know, there's a great documentary.
Called Theremin,
right.
Yes.
And you learn in that documentary that, you know, how the theremin works and that the musician moves his or her hands above the device to disrupt the electromagnetic field that produces the notes.
Hence the reason you never touch the theremin.
Right.
You're affecting this radio wave that's above it.
Right.
You have around it.
Exactly. You have two antennas. One controls the volume. One controls the pitch. Of course, you're using the pitch antenna much more than you're using the volume hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it produces these just very haunting, penetrating sounds. In 1922, Theremin actually demonstrated his invention to Soviet leader Vladimir Lenin. And supposedly, Lenin was given a theremin by the inventor. Can you see him in there with the door locked going, okay, let's play with this? I'm sorry, I had to picture that. Okay, the same year, the first public performance of theremin was given in the Soviet Union, and Theremin gained fame and was from then on called the Soviet Edison and found himself the toast of the town in New York City in 1927 and decided to stay. Now, the instrument's first public performance was in 1928 in the Metropolitan Opera House. And Theremin, actually around that same time, I don't know who decided to do this, but they made or manufactured, I guess you would say, 1,000 theremins in the U.S. And they took off pretty well right at the beginning. And then the stock market crash hit. And there was this glut of theremins on the market. You know, I don't know what happened to them. I'm sure some of them are still around. Some of them probably not. We know that he also at that time met Clara Rockmore. They became romantically involved. And then one day in 1938, Theremin mysteriously disappeared. It was later learned, at least most people say he had been kidnapped by the KGB, which sounds like probably the what happened, because he was taken back to the Soviet Union, reported dead, but was actually in a Siberian labor camp where many prominent intellectuals and Russians with contacts in the West were rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. And I'm holding the quotey things with
yes.
my fingers. Now, he did get to return to New York City, but he was 92 years old at the time. And Clara Rockmore actually was reunited with him after 50 years of not seeing him. Now, she was born in 1911 in Lithuania and was a child prodigy on the violin and actually attended the Imperial Conservatory of St. Petersburg when she was only 5 years old and remains to this day the youngest student ever to be admitted into this institution.
So a musical prodigy.
Oh, yeah. Now, the unfortunate thing was she had some kind of bone disease that resulted from childhood malnutrition. Mm. And she was this fabulous violinist. She started having trouble in her late teens. And by the time she hit her early 20s, she couldn't even play anymore. And this led to the discovery of the theremin, which was just, you know, an absolute miracle for her. She became the most renowned female player of the instrument. Some people call her the queen of the theremin. On the CD, Clara Rockmore's Lost Theremin album, this is when she kept thinking, why doesn't, you know, I wish somebody could have recorded this, and they never did in her lifetime, but they have now, and I'm sure she would be totally thrilled. But she also had help with this by Robert Moog, who, you know, of the Moog synthesizer. Right. He actually had her original theremin. She went to see him, or he came to see her, actually, because her theremin had some broken connections and wires that had just worn away. And so he and a friend of his worked on her theremin for her. And, you know, she'd listen and go, no, this isn't quite right, you know, and until finally they had fixed it exactly, you know, to her specifications, and she was very, very happy. And that's probably an instrument, no matter how old you get, you can still play.
I would assume.
Well, this CD, Kyle, Clara Rockmore's Lost Theremin album. And this is back in the time when the theremin was considered a classical instrument. As we said, you know, the first performance was at the Met. Mm-hmm. And it has some wonderful music on it by Kreisler, Dvorak, Schubert, Chopin, Bach, Ravel, Lecuona, Ponce, Bach, Villa-Lobos. The thing that just blows my mind is, well, I don't even want to say. How about summertime? I'm going to try some summertime.
Sure. It's familiar. You know that summertime, but it's not like any version I'd ever heard.
Although it sounds like a soprano is
singing
it.
It does.
I mean,
and there is no voice on it. That is theremin and theremin only, right?
That's theremin, and that is talent. That is talent. This woman could control this instrument to the point that you're going, what? Can we hear some music by Villa-Lobos? Mm-hmm. It's the aria from Bachianus Brasileiras, number 5.
This is the theremin front and center as a musical instrument. We're very familiar in our culture with the theremin in the background of science fiction movies.
Yeah, special kind of music, but also special effects.
Right.
And they've turned it into this eerie thing. Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin has even used a theremin. I mean, you would never recognize it.
Beach Boys, of course, had perhaps the most heard theremin in Good Vibrations.
Oh, yeah.
On the wind that lifts her perfume through the air, I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitation.
vibrations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations.
And Brian Wilson actually bought his theremin from Robert Moog. Robert Moog became so into the theremin as a kid that he started making theremin kits that he sold to people when he was in high school. And Brian Wilson bought one of his theremin kits and put the theremin together. And there you have good vibrations.
So you have made this like three-person connection from Lennon, not John Lennon, Lennon to the Beach Boys.
Exactly. Wow, who'd have thought?
and you did bring in some film scores that that included in Spellbound.
Yes, Spellbound used a theremin. These are film scores of Miklos Rocha, who also did the theremin in The Red House. And remember the movie The Lost Weekend?
Ray Milland is the director.
Yeah, remember the bat coming through the wall? He's visualizing it. Mm-hmm. There's a theremin there. It's always used, or almost always used, in some kind of creepy, creepy way. And see, it can actually be used in a very beautiful way as well.
I'd love for John Jeter or someone to perhaps get a theremin sometime in the future for the Fort Smith Symphony season. Wouldn't that be fun?
Let everyone call him. I'll give you his number.
And once again, Clara Rockmore's Lost Theremin album. It's available commercially?
Yes, it is. It's on the Bridge record label. Thank you, Bridge.
And thank you, PJ. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Springdale, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen online at our website, KUAF.com. KUAF and Harvest Music Festival invite you to register for the Harvest Music Festival Getaway Giveaway. One lucky winner will receive 2 3-day passes plus general camping to the Harvest Music Festival October 14th, 15th, and 16th on Mulberry Mountain in Ozark. This outdoor event will include over 50 live performances plus camping, hiking, and children's activities. Bands include Leftover Salmon, Keller Williams and the Keels, Sam Bush, and more. The drawing will be held Friday, September 24th. You can hear that drawing live during Film Score Friday with P.J. Hrabowski. Visit KUAF.com and click on Contest to enter the drawing. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks for listening. Have a great Tuesday.